Okay, so Matt, yesterday we talked about CantoBite, and you left my mind open. One of my complaints about CantoBite was sort of this contrived, lazy storytelling, this deus ex machina of, hey, we just happen to be in a jail cell with this dude. There's another moment, and it's a big moment. It's a pinnacle moment in The Last Jedi that feels like it's another deus ex machina. Like, you might even call it a one in a million opportunity that can't ever be repeated again. But before we get into that, dear listener, welcome back to Last Jedi Final Debate. This is where Matt tries to convince me that The Last Jedi is actually a good movie. And in yesterday's episode, he did a really good job of that.
Maybe it is.
And maybe I try to convince you that it's not a good movie, but I am so far failing in that. But welcome back. We're glad that you're here. If you love this content, please make sure you hit that subscribe button and go ahead and share this out with a friend of yours, whether they love or hate The Last Jedi. We're going to be speaking to both sides of that. Okay, so Matt, a one in a million maneuver, something that could never happen again, something that we had never seen before. It could never happen again. A great pinnacle moment. Everything comes together in this to close out the second act of the movie, and that is Vice Admiral Holdo jumping to light speed, going and kamikaze style with the Resistance's last cruiser right into Snoke's ship, the Holdo maneuver. All right. I will say, let me give two things that I actually love about this.
Ooh, okay. You're feeling generous today.
I'm feeling generous. I'm going to give you two freebies. Number one is I do like a good foreshadowing moment. And we got a foreshadowing moment with Leia coming in from space after the bridge had been destroyed. She's using the Force to come back into the ship. And there's a hologram of Snoke's ship. And Leia goes right through it, slices it, and the hologram dissolves. Right? Great foreshadowing moment. As a story analysis kind of person, I love things like that. I love when things get set up and there's payoff. And the second thing I'm going to say is, what a payoff visually. Like, you're sitting in a movie theater and a ship goes to light speed into another ship. And you just had this major contrast of darkness and these little thin bands of light. And there's no sound. There's no music. Like, it was a moment to remember when, boom, you saw that. And you're like, I never imagined anything like that ever before. And it was. So there you go.
So That's exactly where I wanted. Yeah, thank you. I mean, that was great. I was going to say, before we dive into this, like, what was your theatrical experience with this? Because I do feel like this is one where, like, when you're experiencing it the first time is amazing. And obviously, I'm a defender of it, but it seems like something that would only bother you as you dwell on it and consider all kinds of things afterwards. Like, what are the implications? What does this mean now? Like, and I understand that, like, and that's kind of what happens when we see new things. Now, I will say, you wouldn't believe this, Aaron, but before people were mad about this movie, people were mad about Episode 7, The Force Awakens. And if you'll recall, people who don't like the sequel trilogy will remember that a lot of the feedback on The Force Awakens was, oh, well, this is just The New Hope.
Right.
Reskinned in new Star Wars things. And, like, they aren't wrong. And those opinions are valid. But I am not here to defend that movie. I'm here to defend this movie. We'll save that for another time. But we didn't get a lot of new things. We certainly had remixes of things that we had already experienced, and maybe a character that wouldn't have held the lightsaber here doing this and that, all that. The Last Jedi gives us a decent amount of new things. And I think the Holdo maneuver, like, when you're thinking about light speed and you're playing with your toys as a kid, or like talking about what things could happen, like, this feels like something that, like, would have been thought of by a couple of kids playing with their Star Wars toys. And to be able to see it on the big screen, to me, was, like, very rewarding. Now, that doesn't address some of the other discussion points that we're going to cover, but I will just say that it was a really cool idea using things that have been established, weaponizing a thing that we knew about, the hyperspace, and seeing what it could be done, what could be done with it, I guess, opens up the possibilities of what could be done in that regard. And so my I guess, open question with that point is, like, how good is our appetite to seeing new things? Like, on the one hand, people were upset that one thing felt way too familiar, that we didn't get anything fresh or new. And then on the other hand, it's like, we got something new, but not that. That's not what I meant.
Yeah, that's not what I meant. Yeah, I suppose you could say that no matter what happened, there's going to be a corner of the fan base that's going to complain, right? And hey, I get that. I understand that. So here's my biggest thing with the Holdo maneuver is, how does jumping to light speed work in Star Wars? So, like, I wouldn't say the only reason, but a key verisimilitude, let's go back, that's been our theme unintentionally for this thing, right? And inner consistency of reality,
I think,
following the laws of the universe, right? Like, when we watch A New Hope episode 4 and the Millennium Falcon jumps to light speed, we're all like, whoa. Now all of a sudden we can see how space travel, mythology, fantasy, how it plays out, how it's possible, how you can explore all of this crazy new stuff. But this is like an established mechanic in Star Wars, is ships can travel faster than the speed of light, and somehow communication and all those things can too, because it's almost near instantaneous across the galaxy. Sometimes there's a delay, you're still traveling for a few hours. But when the laws of jumping to hyperspeed are established in A New Hope, you've got the farm boy, the whiny farm boy Luke, who's like saying, we're just going to sit here with them gaining. And Han Solo's like, this isn't crust and dust and crops, boy. You would want to bounce into a supernova, or, you know, all those things. Like, he's navigating this jump to light speed, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't exactly know what that means mechanically. This isn't science fiction. But we have some sense of, okay, going to light speed, while it's a regular thing in this universe, it's fairly dangerous and it's not easy. And you have to do complex calculations before you can do it. It doesn't seem like you can kind of just do it anywhere at any point, at any time, with anything. Like, you have to be somewhat careful and deliberate about this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of all that we got about light speed at the time. And then you have The Force Awakens, and you've got Han Solo, who again is teaching us about the mechanics of jumping to light speed. And what was the thing? They were trying to get out of the cargo bay of the bigger ship, right? The Millennium Falcon was trying to escape, and we're like, oh man, can you go to light speed through it? Like, how does this work? Like, it wasn't treated kind of with the same careful, deliberate, oh, you don't want to bounce into a supernova.
Yeah.
And tear yourself to like tiny little particles too fast. Like, it was just sort of like space pirate Han Solo is just breaking all the rules and everything like that. And so those are kind of the two key moments, I think, that lead up to me, at least in the films, of how jumping to hyperspeed works. And then Holdo maneuver just goes and is like, no, we're going to do this all. We're just going to throw it all in our head. We're going to subvert it. We're going to invert it, as has been also another unintentional theme of our discussion. Vice Admiral Holdo is going to do this. It's going to be self-sacrifice. It's going to be heroic. It's going to be this great moment. But we're going to break all the rules of everything that we thought we knew about light speed to do it. And that for me is, I'm still trying to find, what is the inner consistency of reality in jumping to light speed in the Star Wars? And like, these things matter, because this is a world, this is a universe, this is a story that is dependent upon being able to travel faster than light. So there needs to be some rules that are consistent around this, right, in order for the story to be powerful.
I totally agree with that. And I think, on one hand, just to set the stage here, I believe that whatever explanations or establishments that have happened outside of the movies can't matter in the context of the critique of this movie. Like,
yeah,
sure, as a Star Wars fan, you can bring in all that other stuff, but like, as a viewer watching the movie, if it doesn't stand on its own within the rules established in the movies, like you rightfully brought up, how what has been established in the films, right? We can use that. I don't think we can use any of the explanations. I'm positive it's explained elsewhere, but we're just going to take it at the value of the films itself. And I think what we do know, like you said, like, oh yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, so we're not going to talk about the book of Tarkin right? Which actually dives into a little bit of the science of jumping to hyperspeed, if I remember right.
We can. We can. I don't think
we need to, because as you say, we're looking at the inconsistency that is established in the movies as a movie viewer, rather than I know all of the things about Star Wars. I've read Wikipedia 3 times over, every single page, right? And I know how this works. Like, we're not going that end of the spectrum, but it's like, what is the experience of seeing the story played out on the screen?
Yeah. And so I guess adding to what you said, like, we do know that there's calculations involved, right? You have to calculate. It is a complex thing to do. The point that I would make about this is this feels like when you first watch it, it feels like, oh my gosh, you can do that. Like, now this everything we know is broken. Like, all the possibilities are endless. But I would invite everyone to take a step back and look at what actually happened and then be practical about how you would go about strategizing a similar thing ever again. Not that you couldn't do it again. Let's pretend that you could do it again. Let's pretend that everybody could do the Holdo maneuver easily. Number one, it didn't even destroy the ship. Like, it ripped through the ship, but half the characters are still on that ship and they survive.
And they still have gravity. And
they still, like, mechanisms go into place. Like, this isn't a Titanic situation. Like, they were able to save the ship from sinking. It doesn't explode the ship entirely like the Death Star we saw in A New Hope, right? It rips through. It causes damage. It does give them enough of a distraction to get away and make it to Crait, which they didn't even fully outrun them there either, right? It created a hurdle. It didn't even win the battle for them.
Yeah, just slowed them down.
So we kind of make this thing a little bit bigger than it is. It's not blowing up the Death Star or Starkiller Base. We literally fired our only shot possible at them to give us just enough to get away. So, and in order to do that, they had to onboard everybody. They were only willing to sacrifice one person. And I can't imagine that the ship that they ended up sacrificing, whatever that would have cost this resistance to have that ship, would have been worth hyperspacing through another ship on a regular basis.
Yeah, I agree with you. And this is kind of actually like my response is like, well, kamikaze is not a practical form of warfare, right? But since the beginning of sea battles, ramming into other ships has actually been a very established, like the Romans used to do this, right? This is a very established sort of thing of ramming speed, you know, we're going to ram our ship into it. And the thing that Star Wars did that was really interesting was, well, we're going to ram, what's ramming? Ramming speed, that's way too slow. We're going to go light speed. We're going to go ram at light speed. And I agree with you, like the idea of, oh, well, now this is now an established military tactic of we're going to ram our ships with light speed into other ships. Like, you're going to run out of ships really fast. And if you are a fledgling resistance or rebel alliance against the tyrannical, oppressive empire or First Order, you don't have that many ships to begin with.
This podcast is sponsored by Bragboard. Quick question. Have you ever been asked, what did you accomplish this quarter? And your mind just goes blank? Not because you didn't do anything, but because the work is scattered across Slack, docs, meetings, your memory, or worse, your managers. That used to happen to me all the time. Bragboard is a simple tool that captures your work as it happens, and it turns it into clear, credible proof you can actually use in reviews or one-on-ones. So when the question comes up, you are ready, not scrambling. If that sounds familiar, check out Bragboard today. Visit bragboard.work to start your 42-day free trial. That's bragboard.work.
But the other part for me is it's like, okay, well, if now we have established fact that you can take a physical object and speed it up to light speed in the direction of another physical object, maybe ships are impractical, but why are we not seeing like light speed torpedoes? Or light-speed missiles, or heck, the bombs that destroyed the freaking dreadnought right, that we talked about a couple days ago. Like, why are those not enabled with light-speed engines? And then all of a sudden they can shoot towards a ship at light speed and avoid all the lasers, do all those different things. Then we don't lose our bomber squadron. We're just going to shoot hyperspeed, light-speed missiles, torpedoes, call them what you will, nuclear bombs from our little base as we're evacuating.
Yeah. And I mean, we're gonna talk around it, and this is kind of the schoolyard debate on like why you wouldn't, right?
Yeah.
Like neither of us can be right because it's like nobody yeah. knows.
Nobody
why
knows. Why wouldn't they? It's non-existent. Yeah, but continue.
Yeah, yeah. But I would just say like we saw a giant ship hyperspace through another giant ship and didn't even destroy it, right? So if somehow I'm able to attach a hyperdrive to a bomb, which just someone's gonna hate mail you and like, you guys don't know what a hyperdrive looks like? You couldn't attach that to a bomb. Like, no. But if you were, just play with us.
Let's just assume in Star Wars that they'd figure out the technology to do that.
They did it. They did yeah. it. And they tried to hyperspace through a bomb. Like, is a bomb that size going to do more damage than this giant ship that just hyperspaced through this thing? Like, how many of those are you going to have to develop? How are you going to calculate the right coordinates for it to hit the right thing at the right time? Like, yeah, you could just try to hyperspace bombs through there constantly. But then are you crowding the hyperspace lanes with bombs? Like,
hey, it is Star Wars.
At that point?
Like, it's Star Wars. Yeah.
Yeah.
But your point is like, hey, it didn't fully destroy the ship. So this is like an impractical, like the end result wasn't fully a pulverized destroyed ship. And I'd say, yeah, true, it wasn't. But also at the same time, Snoke's ship was an impractically sized ship. Like it was 500 times larger than the typical Star Destroyer. So if we take the Resistance's biggest cruiser and we light speed that into, you know, the typical Star Destroyer first class, like, would that have the same effect? Would it pulverize both ships in that case?
I mean, it probably would. And that's where I invite anyone who's listening who's a chess person, talk about the queen for a queen sacrifice. Like, in what circumstances is that worth it? Maybe, you know? I think there's factors of, like, size of military resources, like, that ship was probably worth a lot more to the Resistance than the other ship was to the First Order at this juncture.
Yeah, relatively, for sure.
But yeah, that would be my defense of the Holdo maneuver.
Yeah. Your defense is the impracticality of it, right? It's just impracticality, and it didn't have the full end result. It was a delaying tactic for the shuttles to be able to get down to the planet.
Yeah, and it feels different, and it feels new, and it feels unfair because I feel like we attach like sort of this overpowered move to light speed. It's certainly a great escape tactic, but I feel like if anything, this shows, like I said, how impractical it would be to try to do on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And interesting. It just occurred to me too, that in this sequel trilogy in Episode 7, we get a little more rules about how jumping at light speed works with Han jumping out of the ship. We get the Holdo maneuver, which is like, well, ramming speed at light speed, what does that look like? But then in Episode 9, we also get some new establishment of rules around light speed, where you have that opening scene of the Millennium Falcon jumping through all those things, and then, hey, the engine overheats, right? What does that actually do to the engine? So it's like, okay, maybe we're starting to learn a little bit more what the rules of hyperspeed are and jumping to hyperspace.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it is more complicated than Dustin Cropp's book. So maybe we'll just have to chalk it up to the 1 in a million chance. The Force just happened to give them a very narrow opportunity. And Vice Admiral Holdo did the most heroic thing to sacrifice for.
It was worth a shot.
Let's take a minute, though, Matt. I mean, you've alluded to this before, where you kind of feel like the Holdo maneuver is the culmination of a few different story arcs, right? You've got Finn and Rey who are on the ship. Finn and Rose were on the ship at the same time doing their failure. You've got Rey and Kylo on the ship, and where Rey's trying to turn Kylo, but he fails. You've got Snoke who gets cut in half. You've got the Resistance who they're making their last ditch effort to get off of the planet, right? So we're transitioning from the space race to now this planet-based battle. So talk a little bit about why you feel like the Holdo maneuver is or is not a good culmination of kind of those different threads coming together.
I mean, a large complaint about this movie is that it's just like this slow chase of two giant ships And how boring is that, right? And so we're following these storylines, as I've alluded to, like you get some good character development in these different storylines. You visit the island with Luke. Like while all this is happening, while the chase is happening, Rey is still on that planet with Luke at the beginning of it. Finn starts off like in a coma. He misses that first battle. So he's like disoriented, hasn't fully bought into the resistance. He's still just wondering about Rey. Poe is being a hotshot, know-it-all. And so I feel like it kind of breaks the movie into the two halves, similar to the ship breaking into two halves, similar to the lightsaber breaking into the two halves, similar to Snoke being ripped into two halves. Mm-hmm. And that is the end of the race, or this chase scene. The lightsaber breaks at the same time. These stories come back together, and then they're able to all finish the story together, now all on Crate through the third act of the movie.
Yeah, you do have this moment where everything splits. Everything splits. And I guess going back to kind of what we were talking about with Finn yesterday, which is there's no gray anymore. There's no in-between anymore. You're on one side or the other, right? Like you say, the ship gets torn in half, the lightsaber gets torn in half, Snoke gets torn in half. So it's like, it's very clear now, nope, there's a light side and there's a dark side, and which one are you going to choose? And I actually think it culminates right there in Kylo and Rey, and we'll talk about their story here soon, but it's like,
yeah,
which side absolutely are they going to choose? Like you had this moment of them coming together at a very light speed type speed, and then not, but we'll get into that. But mm-hmm. I think visually, hold the maneuver, absolutely great. Does it follow an inner consistency of reality? Question still out there for me. I don't know how practical this would be. What would this look like? It was sort of explained away in episode 9 of like, let's do some hold the maneuvers. It's like, no, that's like one in a million. We can't do that again. But it's like, we don't really hear why very subtly, you know? And so I think,
yeah,
there was some subtle storytelling with the whole foreshadowing of Leia going through, but I think a little more subtle storytelling of why that was even possible in the first place probably would save a lot of us a lot of this grief. Like, I go back to Han Solo teaching Luke Skywalker and us for the very first time about hyperspeed works. Like, they're very fast lines, and Han says them like it's just like his everyday thing, you know? But it's establishing rules for us. And I don't know if Hux and his guy on the big dreadnought, if they could have been like, shoot, is there a hyperlane gate behind us? Or if they could, like, just one line, or somebody on that bridge realizes she's at point A and she's going to jump to hyperspeed at point B and we're right here in the middle. Maybe I should tell General Hux, oh, but no, he's a smart guy. Like, some moment or some line or something that just indicates like, hey, just so you know, we're following an inner consistency of reality rather than just we're going to blow up your mind. And I don't think it would have lessened the moment at all. I don't think it would have been anything, but it's like some really subtle storytelling that establishes a rule or a twist of a rule would have set us up for a payoff there. But I've never been a director, writer, producer of a Star Wars movie, so what do I know? But that's just kind of my take on powerful storytelling.
Valid. Awesome.
Okay, so where do we land on this one, Matt? Have we convinced either of us that Hold the Maneuver was good or bad?
I mean, if I were a jury and I were reviewing the evidence of it being a bad thing versus a good thing, and it being a bad thing means I have to give it the death penalty, I don't think I have enough evidence to give it a death penalty.
This is not beyond a shadow of a doubt, you say?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. That's good. Well, I'll chalk it up as, wow, that was really beautiful to see that first time you watch it. It is breathtaking. But does it follow an inner consistency of reality? I'm not sure on that one. So I agree with you. I couldn't say beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is an absolutely terrible thing that makes The Last Jedi terrible, but I think there's still some open questions for me.
This podcast is sponsored by Bragboard. Quick question, have you ever been asked, what did you accomplish this quarter? And your mind just goes blank? Not because you didn't do anything, but because the work is scattered across Slack, docs, meetings, your memory, or worse, your managers. That used to happen to me all the time. Bragboard is a simple tool that captures your work as it happens, and it turns it into clear, credible proof you can actually use in reviews or one-on-ones. So when the question comes up, you are ready, not scrambling. If that sounds familiar, check out Bragboard today. Visit bragboard.work to start your 42-day free trial. That's bragboard.work.